We'll just go ahead because daylight's burning, right? I had a slideshow as opposed to. We're supposed to have that working, but I'm not sure what's how it's doing because I've got pictures to, as a slideshow for some of the pictures that we did on the project. But we'll go ahead and start. My name is Kent Miles. I'm the author, I guess the surviving author of this book, Mormon Women, Portraits and Conversations. And we have four women with us today that were included in the book. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the project, how it came about, and then we'll turn the time over to these women to talk a little bit about some of the people in the book that they found interesting, some of the principles or ideas, concepts in the book that they think are compelling. About 10 years ago, a friend of mine named Jim Kimball and I spent some time talking about a project that we'd like to do together. Now, Jim, you may have known from his Remembering Uncle Golden. He did the presentations of J. Golden Kimball stories, who was his great uncle. He did a couple of videos with KUED, and did performances around, live presentations. Jim and I had been friends for many, many years. And we'd done a lot of work together, but never really come up with a project to work on that we felt had substance and would be worth working on together over a period of time. And finally, one day, my dad suggested, well, why don't you do something on Mormon women? They never get any press. That's a real untold story. And as soon as we heard that, we knew that's right. That's what we want to do. Because Jim is widely traveled, throughout the world. We were both conscious that, one of the great secrets to Mormonism and the congregations of the church is the women. That really have a significant role in making those branches work. So we began, and we had never done this kind of a project before, but we didn't let that stop us. We started out, we got referrals, there were names of women that some we knew and some we didn't, and we just started making contact with people who had an interesting story. We started the interviews. Jim was a remarkable person in that I don't know anybody that knew him or met him that didn't feel a great affection for him and feel a closeness to him. And as the result of his particular talents, he was able to bring to the interview an atmosphere, I think, that conveyed acceptance. It was non-judgmental. It was friendly. It was interest. And as a result, that quality enabled the women that we talked with, I think, to be open and candid and to feel safe in these conversations that we had together. The way we found women were referrals. Friends of friends. As we'd interview people or new people in different parts of the world, they said, I know somebody that you ought to interview. Elder Pinnock was very useful in helping to connect us with Kathy, among others, and Ann Perry in Scotland. We wanted to include women that had remarkable stories, but that also had a breadth of experience. As we started doing the project over several years, starting to come together, our initial idea was, coffee table book. Big picture, short text. But you know what? The interviews wouldn't allow that treatment. What the women said in the course of the interview was so compelling and so interesting that to try to narrow it down to a page or two of text was inadequate. It did not justify. We couldn't do it. And so we wrestled with how we were going to finally come to terms with the book. About 4 or 5 years ago, Jim came down with a brain tumor. And he passed away in the spring of 2005, I think it was. And that kind of slowed me down. You know, it was difficult to continue, but we felt a need to do it. And about a year and a half ago, Jim's son and some friends that knew the project got us all together and said, Ed said, my dad really wanted to finish this. And that was enough to get us going and to get back and to finish the project. I think the important thing about the book for me is that it enabled, in some respect, a new type of literature in the LDS oeuvre of literature. It's the oral history as literature rather than just as source material. You know, what these women had to say was compelling, was interesting, was worth listening to. And the nature of their lives and what they had to say was worth considering. They spoke beautifully and eloquently, and the great pleasure for me was to go back through the interviews, to re-edit, to find their voices, you know, to be able to convey what they said in the clearest, in the clearest way possible. I have found that the material is forever fresh. You know, it doesn't get stale. I can go back and read it and still find the same interesting and compelling content. Well, I'm very appreciative of Dan Thomas and of Handcart Books for publishing the book. We have here to my left, your right, Angela Cummings, Catherine Stokes, Victoria Kessler, and Emma Lou Thane. Briefly, I'll read from the introduction to each of them. There is, by the way, a volume 2 we're planning on for this next spring. Angela, at the time of the interview, is one of the most sought-after jewelry designers in the world. She was a native of Germany, came to the United States out of design school, and quickly began her career at Tiffany's in New York City. She soon had her very own product line and an exclusive display counter in its Manhattan shop. And after leaving Tiffany, she and her husband, Bruce, operated their own successful company. That is a very brief introduction to Angela. She will say more about a little bit about who she is, and she says more about her life experience in the book. We also have Victoria. We first interviewed Kathy is next in line, so that's
fine.
I'm just trying to go in order of the... Let's see. Okay, well, Victoria's on page 66, so that's easy to find. Okay, Victoria is a homemaker and mother of 12. She was the daughter of Chinese immigrants, and she was given up for adoption at an early age. Throughout her life, she's overcome adversity through her strong personal faith and the support of her family. She's active in her ward, where she teaches, conducts music, works with public affairs, and that was recently released as a Relief Society president. We first did our interview with you down at BYU Education Week, wasn't it? At Women's Week. Women's Week at BYU. Okay. We also... Catherine... who is on page 106. Catherine is a wonderful breath of fresh air. You will love Catherine. Anyway, here is what we have here. She was a professional nurse by training and also held a number of positions. She finished up her career in public health as a public health administrator. She also had a role in preparation for bioterrorism preparedness and response. She retired after 34 years of service in the Illinois Department of Public Health and now resides here in Salt Lake. And Emma Lou?
Needs no introduction.
Well, that's not true. Well, you know Emma Lou. She's a published author, poet, mother of five. She taught English, coached tennis at the University of Utah for several years. She gives lectures around the country to universities, churches, community groups, and is a very avid tennis player.
That's why I'm in a wheelchair.
That's why she's in a wheelchair. Her curiosity about life and her gift of language has won numerous awards, including the prestigious Madeline Award for Distinguished Service to the Arts and Humanities and the David O. McKay Humanities Award from BYU. Again, these are just little brief introductions. But most of all, I'd like them to tell you a little bit about themselves, or even more importantly, about the book, how it came to be for them, and what they feel now that it's in print, the significance of it is. So, what did you expect? Anybody? Who would like to start? Angela?
I'll start since I'm here. I first met.
Does this work? One, two, three. Does that work?
Yes.
Okay, I need to have it up right.
So Jim Kimball was a good friend of mine. It doesn't work, but that's okay. Can everybody?
it
is working? Okay. Jim Kimball was a good friend of my husband's. That's, I think, how I got into this book, because I don't know how else I would have gotten in this book. But I remember the interview was about 11 years ago, and I was a fairly recent convert at the time. But I liked him immediately. He was so funny. I mean, when he talked about Golden's, some of his things, I just thought he was just the greatest, funniest guy. He was a little bit, and my husband's like that too, so they were very good friends. And it was done 11 years ago, and I really have, I think, grown in many ways since then. So, I was just... I just feel I was so much younger in my outlook on life. But the thing when I read this book, which I love this book, and I am so in awe of some of these women. And if I'm thinking of a thread that goes through it, I can only say that I'm in awe of the courage of these women. They were women that faced huge difficulties, very frightening situations that I don't know, honestly don't think I could have gotten through like that, but it was their faith that made them courageous, I think. And I think that is the one thing that comes through, that faith is what makes these women courageous. And I think it was faith that made the pioneer women courageous. When I first learned about the pioneer, the movement west, I didn't know any of this. I came from Germany. I was a blank slate as far as Mormonism goes. But when I learned about the women, I was so impressed by their strength, their courage, and their endurance. And I think even the women in this book that comes through, I'm excluding myself because I don't think I would have had that kind of endurance for some of these situations, but I think we get what strength we need, and that's what I got from the book.
Hi, well... Excuse me. I have to tell you, I was the fly in the buttermilk because I didn't want to do the book. This seemingly crazy man called me up and he wanted me to be in his book, and I said no thanks. And that stunned him, and so he went away for a little while. And then my good friend Laurie Stromberg called me from California and said, well, Kathy, I don't know this guy, but they're friends of mine whom I trust completely, who say he's a wonderful person. I said, and let me tell you his name. I said, Lori, I don't want to be in the book. And she said, well, why not? I said, well, they say you're entitled to 15 minutes in the spotlight. I've already been in it 45. I want to be in the book. So that was that. The next person calling me on the phone was Elder Hugh Pinnock, area president. Sister Kathy, how are you? I said, President, tell me what you want. I'll tell you how I am. And he says, now, sister. I said, don't now me. You want something. You know, it's like I think they sit around. I think I'll call member number 9,400,000. No, they always want something. And so he says, well, there's a friend he went to high school with and grew up. I said, yeah, Jim Kimball, I know. And then he said, well, what's the problem with this? I said, number one, I don't like the title. The title then was something like Remarkable Mormon Women. I said, you know, when you first hear that, it tends to separate the women. I said, all women are remarkable. That's how God created them. And I said, that's the first thing. Number two, I said, he probably has a remarkable woman in his kitchen. Let him put her in the book. And indeed, she is a remarkable woman. And so he said, well, we'll make you a deal. Beware of general authorities making deals. So the deal was to change the title. And I can't think of the other things we discussed. But at any rate, I said, okay, I'll do it. Now, I didn't pick the title. I think it was probably... whomever.
Yeah,
I think
it's
a perfectly obvious title. Because that's what it is, Portraits and Conversations. And so then he said, well, he would come out to Chicago. And I said, no. I'll come to Salt Lake, and then I can visit my friends on your dime. And so then he invited me to stay with him. And I said, don't you have to ask your wife? And he said, no. I have come to understand that these two people are like, you know, that old hand in glove kind of thing. But they are just, number one, delightful, have the gift of hospitality. Joan Kimball is an elegant, elegant dressed, just, you know, she looks like she stepped out the magazine every time you see her. And you wonder, how does she do that? Makes you very, very comfortable in the home. So long story short, I stayed in their home. And then I, indeed, was very comfortable with Jim Kimball. Loved Uncle Bolton. But in regards to this book, I don't think we ought to tell these people about our story, or then they won't buy the book. Now, you know, hey, this is America. We got to get the economy doing something. But anyway, one of my favorite scriptures is Proverbs 31, which talks about the virtuous woman. Let me just give you some phrases from that scripture. Safely trust in her. It says the heart of her husband does safely trust in her. But safely trust in her. She will do good all the days of her life. Worketh willingly with her hands. Girdeth her loins with strength and strengtheneth her arms. Perceiveth that her merchandise is good. She stretcheth out her hand to the poor. Yea, she reacheth forth her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow, for her household is prepared. Strength and honor are her clothing. She openeth her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. She eateth not the bread of idleness. Favor is deceitful. Beauty is vain. But a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her at the gates. And so in this book you have humanitarian, a jewelry designer, business owner, a former guerrilla medic. Talk about strengthening your loins and your arms. And who's also a teacher, a city manager, a homemaker with 12 children. So she's got to have all the skills that all the other people have. You know, it's, and then some. Historian. Public health administrator, Gulag survivor, teacher, mystery novelist, who brings a respite from your everyday busyness and whatever. You can lose yourself in a wonderful book. I love Ann Perry's books. I'm so taken by the description of the social events and mores of the time that I don't care who done it by the time we get to the end of it. But indeed, it's always a fine mystery. News anchor for the deaf, sign language instructor, fashion designer, teacher, city council member, chief justice of the Supreme Court. When I read, she openeth her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. And indeed, that does fit the Honorable Chief Justice Christine Durham. Poet, author. And by the way, she authored the words to Where Shall I Turn for Peace, which is one of everybody's favorites in the handbook. And so, this book, and after I finished reading it this time, you know how they say you read the scriptures and every time you get a different view, and that's the truth, because this time, this is a composite in Proverbs of women. There are individuals who their major strength is one of these things, but they have strengths in all of these areas, or almost all of these areas. And so I said, oh, this is a composite. And then I'd read it again, and I said, no, this is a woman. But at any rate, I am impressed that virtue, in talking about a virtuous woman, virtue, according to Merriam-Webster dictionary of some year, I couldn't see the print of, is a conformity to a standard of right, a particular moral excellence, an order of angels. I love that. It reminds me of the song, The Errand of Angels is Given to Women. A beneficial quality of or power of a thing. Valor. Now that is defined as moral strength, manly strength or courage. That cracked me up. The virtuous woman has manly strength and courage. Merit. Now this one, potency, a capacity to act. You see that in the scripture, the virtuous woman. You see that in the women in this book. Then by virtue of, or in virtue of, through the force of, or by authority of. And I believe women have authority. And it is an authority given to us by our Father in heaven. Women are the ones who preserve what is good in the society for the posterity. And as Proverbs ends, let me paraphrase that in terms of women in the church. You know, I'm amazed. I've been a member of the church 30 years at the talent that Mormon women have. And I say then, give them the fruit of her hand, of their hands, and let their own works praise them in the gates. And indeed, that will be. So.
Amen.
Let the church say amen. See? Amen. Hey, there you go. Yeah. Say hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Yes.
Praise the Lord.
Hey, he's worthy.
Well, first let me just say, when I first was approached with this, it was Elder Pinnock. My husband was in the state presidency. And it was just kind of, what? You know, what? It's kind of the same words I used when I was called the Relief Society president. What? But when James Kimball called me and said that Elder Pinnock had referred me to him, to write about me, I said, what? You know? So it's just been kind of a, you know, okay, sure, you know. And then, again, you as you visited with him, you did get that, well, I guess he's okay. With my story, I was for a long time I was very wary to share some of my things as I was growing up and the things that I had gone through. I wasn't wary at all talking about my 12 children or my husband, who is my knight in shining armor. I am who I am because of my Heavenly Father and because of my husband. And I feel that, this book has been a really neat thing. I feel it a privilege to be in it. Would my husband stand up? There he is. Back in the red shirt. The
microphone's up there.
Anyway, he's a wonderful man. Great supporter. I have to say, he learned how to roll ringlets in 8 little daughters' hair. When I was expecting twins, I was kind of put down for, bed, and so that I wouldn't have them early. And so he would take care of the 4 older daughters. The oldest daughter combed her own hair, but I had 4 little girls kind of right in a row. And I was very meticulous with my children because I didn't want to be the mother that somebody says, oh, that poor woman, she can't even get her act together. So anyway, I was very, very meticulous in how my children looked when they went to church and when they went to school. And I still get comments today, all my children are grown and pretty much gone from the area which we raised them. And people still come up and say, oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah, you're so-and-so's mom. And, oh, they always look so beautiful. And so I have to say I'm pleased that people didn't notice my children in that light. Like I said, I am privileged to be in this book. I have to say, Mary said, that there are wonderful people, wonderful women, LDS women all over. I attribute my mother-in-law to be the most wonderful woman. I would wish she was in the book instead of myself. But there, in reading the book, it is fascinating. It to read these women's stories on the trials and adversities that they went through, most all of them getting education at one point or another. I have to say, education wasn't my forte. Mine was raising children that love education. My oldest daughter has her PhD degree in clinical psychology. She works down at Stanford University and does research for breast cancer, and also she just received a grant for that, and also does the pediatric brain research for dysfunctions in the brain in the youth. She does presentations all over different universities. She's going to be doing a presentation in a couple of weeks at Yale. You can Google her, and she's quite famous. So anyway, and each one of my children, I've got a daughter who is going to the University of Utah. She's expecting her second child in 7 weeks, and she just finished up another semester. So my children believe, most of them believe in education and working towards that. So while I had, like I said, that hasn't been my forte, I have taken a few little classes. I took a mini med class last year, and it was very interesting. I appreciate, like I said, each woman that is in this book, and for the fortitude that that both James Kimball and then Kent Miles put into publishing this. I have to say I was a little surprised because it took, you know, when it first happened, I kept waiting and wondering, and because I didn't hear anything, and then last year got a call. Well, they actually called who is a state president, but he was then my bishop, and he called me and said, so-and-so called, and I said, don't know so-and-so. I think it was
Jim's son.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. It was a girl.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So anyway, so yeah.
Probably Cammie.
And she, yeah, Cammie called, and she says, so I went ahead and returned the call and said, I really don't know who you are, but, you know, what do you want? And she says, well, they're going to go ahead and try to do this book, and she says she was heading out of the country, and she came, so she got me in touch with James's son, who then I called, and then it went to the publisher, Dan, who then we worked back and forth. When I first read my thing, I thought, who is this? You know, so we worked together, and the product is in the book, and again, like Mary says, I have to get the book to read it. So that's kind of where it's at with me.
Is there a little more
going
slack on this?
That's
a little bit. Uh-huh, maybe.
Well, not much.
There we go.
That's enough.
That's perfect.
Okay.
Well, I'm probably the only woman in the whole book who never went through any kind of adversity. That's my husband over here. But what I found in this book, and what was very satisfying, to hear the stories of women who have followed their own great, their own bliss, if you will, where they have this tremendous balance of family life, children, and then beyond that, they put in their church time, but then they have what I like to call the full measure of their creation, where they find themselves in ways that don't have anything to do with that household especially, but in ways that they're born with, that is an impulse that's irresistible. And I think that impulse is there in most women, but not very many get the opportunity really to carry through on it. And every one of these has, and I've loved reading about them. But when Jim talked to me, we were old friends. In fact, we played tennis together. He used to take us traveling. He was a travel agent, and I remember when he took us to China, and we were playing tennis on the 11th floor of a huge, big 5-star hotel. Jim was a great, big, tall, lanky guy. He loved words, and he loved people, and he was always like he'd heard. He was somebody that everybody liked. But I'll never forget that being his partner, here we were up on this high place with a fence around it, but when the ball had come to Jim, if it was very high at all, he'd smack that so hard, and it would go over the fence. Every time. I can't tell you how many balls we lost. But he was very decisive in everything he did. And this was sort of typical. But when he wanted to interview me, I thought, oh, what do you want, Jim? This is really fun. And he and I had talked about a lot of things over the years. But when he talked to me, it was about what my life had been as a woman in the church. Now, I'm 84, so I've had lots of experiences. And he was very interested in finding out what those had been. But like these other, like the friends here, we had 5 little children under 10 at one time. And I was teaching at the university. Part-time, I was very lowest on the totem pole in the AIDS department. And I was on the general board of the young women. And I was on the Deseret News Board for 17 years, the only woman. So I was working with the chair of President Kimball, he's now President Monson. He was Tom Monson, and Jim Faust, and Bishop Victor Brown, and Neil Maxwell, and Jeff Holland, and Dallin Oaks, and me. So I was in a position where it was very interesting to go to these meetings, I'll tell you, because I knew I was a token, but they needed a woman. It was in those days where they had to look good and get a woman on the board, and I was it. But I learned a lot from these people. But the thing I learned as much as anything was that they had no idea what a woman's life was like. And remember when we were having a party up at our cabin, and we were sitting around, and they were looking at their watches, and they just said, when were they going to pick up their wives? And here I was up there ahead of time trying to get ready for this party, get freed up to come to the meeting, and then thinking what I had to do when I got there. And I looked around at these men, and I said, I need a wife. And of course, this was kind of the popular saying at the time, but it's really true. And I think the thing that this book does that maybe hasn't been done too thoroughly before is to look at the lives of somebody who has these different roles to play, who is actively doing them all, and yet has this impulse to do something else that's just plain satisfying. Doesn't matter how hard it is, doesn't matter what kind of time it takes. I used to write between 11 and 1 in the morning because it was the only quiet time in the whole time in the house. And I dreamed of a day between Sunday and Monday that nobody knew about but me. So can you imagine a day like that? Without interruption. So I stayed up all night, one night a week, to do this. And I was young enough that if I went to bed at an ordinary time the next night, I was okay. I couldn't do it if I was going to be sitting the next day. That was impossible. But this gave me a kind of life that was a little bit of a secret life for me. Something that I got to do just exactly what I wanted for all that time, because nobody else was present in that moment. Nobody was waiting for me. Nobody expected anything of me. I wasn't arranging, I wasn't fixing, I wasn't doing anything, but just that urgency to find whatever it was that was the full measure of my creation. So in this book, I've just been thrilled to read about all these people and to be part of it. I feel really honored to be part of it and to know what they're all about, and to thank Kent for taking the pictures as well as for the content. But he has a way with a camera that you'll find, you've probably noticed up here. It's a lot more than a picture of a face. It's a picture of the intent, of the thing that's making that person tick. And he can bring that out in ways that I've seen few photographers be able to do. So it is, it talks about portraits and conversations, and it is both. And I appreciate, Kent, what you've done, and I appreciate your bringing this out, because Jim did want this to happen. He was so intent on this happening, and it was his dream. I remember we called on him and Jean, just before he died, and the last thing he talked to me about was, the book is going to happen. It's going to be published, and he's all full of all these things. And Joan shook her head and said, none of that is true. It was just this dream that he wanted so much that he thought it would happen. And so for this to have happened now, and for it really to have become a reality, thanks to Kent and the publishers, I think Jim is just smiling like he made all the rest of us smile.
Thank you. One of the things that I find in the book that's a theme over and over again, it's the idea of courage. You know, my father used to quote the old philosopher, American philosopher, Albert Hubbard, who said that faith is vision plus valor. Or in other words, as my father talked about, the ability to see that something needs to be done and the ability to do it, the courage to go out and do it. Or another word, if we were to cut it down to one word, it would be initiative. And that's a theme that is repeated over and over again in the lives of all of the women that we interviewed. There is initiative. There is the ability to see something that needs to be done or ought to be done or that they desire to do, and they will do it. Now, so, for example, with Laurel Ulrich, she talks about taking 10 years to get her master's. you know, and another 10 to get her doctorate after that. And, you know, but so what? If it takes 5 years or 10 years, we're going to be 10 years older in 10 years anyway, right? But it was a matter to do, you know, one bite-sized chunk, one class a semester, maybe two, to do it, work it out, and put it together. One thing I'd like to talk about is another aspect that we see over and over again in the book that I find. It's the idea of creativity. Now, creativity, as people have, you know, as we talked about it in here, as it became revealed, is the idea of the ability to solve problems. You know, to look at an issue, a problem that needs to be met, and figure out how best to solve it. And everybody has their own processes and their own creative procedures that they go through. One of the things I found interesting, and I'd like to ask Angela about this, when we talked before, was the process of that you went through in creating your designs. And what happened with that once you joined the church and the perspective that you had on creativity. Could you address that for a little bit?
Well, I think before I joined the church, I think that I put too much emphasis on creativity in my life. I thought I made it too important. And I joined the church right after I had my son. And that's when I suddenly realized I had a great job, I love the job, but it isn't that important. There are many more important things in life. But we also need a stage to sort of keep busy. So that was my stage to keep busy. But my family became really important, and my faith became really important, and more important than that. So even today, I'm not really working the way I was, but I still do a little bit. But I found that actually what I did was better, because I had a better vision of beauty, which to me is synonymous with goodness. I think good things are always beautiful. And I just learned a lot of things. I learned a lot of things coming to Utah with this spectacular nature around here. And it's sort of prophetic. The picture you took of me, was it 12 years ago, 11 years? It was just a long time ago. The picture of me in there, it was so perfect, because if there was such a thing as wood fairies, I would have been a wood fairy. But my creativity became very... I got it in perspective, because it's a gift. It isn't, you know, it isn't... I wasn't creative and I wasn't good at what I was doing because of me. I was always that way because God gave me that gift, and I learned that.
Would any of you others like to comment upon creativity as you've encountered it or as you read about in the book?
Come on, creative women.
Well, there's an old saying that necessity is the mother of invention, or creativity, if you will. Creating out of need, which I think we do when the pressure of the need focuses keenly enough, we then become creative and figure out how to get it done, and sometimes in ways that haven't happened before.
Anyone would like to address that? If not, I'll ask another question. It's up to you.
Should I go on this one?
If you'd like to.
Okay. It's an interesting thing. I think we're born with such things that we don't really realize. And as we go through life, all of a sudden something pops up and we think, oh yeah, I really like that. But I feel that I was indebted to my birthing parents, say, to my Heavenly Father, for being born with that kind of need to think in new ways, to not ever be satisfied with the way things were. Maybe this is because I grew up in a family of boys, and this is how they thought. So I learned by doing boy talk and with parents who always said, why not? For anything that we could decide. But one of the things that helped, I think, with our creativity was that we lived in the canyon in the summer. We'd go up to my grandmother's cabin the day school was out, live there till school started. And oh my, did we invent and create and do. Every day was some new kind of adventure. And I look at kids now with their you know, they're texting and on front of the TV and with games, and everything is being handed to them. And when do they get a chance to just say, hey, what would really be fun today? What did we make? We made huts and undergrounds and developed ways to kill snakes and, I mean, just crazy things. But every day was full of some kind of adventure. No days were the same. And I think I wouldn't trade that growing up for anything in the world. But now I look at our own children and their children, and I see that this kind of sense of things has flowed down through the generations. Don't you find this? Your children catch on to the same kinds of things. They want to do something inventive. They want to try something. And I've watched what's happened to her. Two of our daughters went to Africa this spring. One had been there before. One teaches art and took an art project from a Central City school to Africa to show these kids and to have them in this small village do a project to come back. But I think, hooray, huzzah, thinking of things that are going to not only be creative in their lives, but which can add to the lives of other people. I mean, that's, I think, what it's all about. What these women have done, as far as I can see, and I love reading their stories.
Here's...
I'll go ahead and address it.
Okay.
Just thinking with my children, you know, it's probably more my grandchildren that say, oh, I'm bored. And I look at them, I think, you know, I've never been bored. And, but as I watch, I have 8 girls, so, and 4 boys. But the girls in watching, well, all my children, but watching each one of them have a unique and different talent and creativity, and I love that. I have done a lot of toll painting, and I love crafts, so that's kind of what I like to do and create different things. And you know, I look at something, and then I want to do more with it. But I have to say I'm a copycat for a little bit. I read your part in your story that, you know, that people sometimes take someone else's design, which is very wrong, and that shouldn't be so. But I like to, as I have created, you know, different things, I add my own little spiff on it, or my spoof, or whatever you call it. And I've noticed with my children, they've picked up on that. My daughters, you know, I've got one, you know, daughter that she's a beautiful photographer. She took a photography class and National Geographic. Photographer, and he was just, you know, to get that kind of praise from a National Geographic photographer was amazing. Another daughter does a little bit of woodworking, and so, you know, it's fun. I've got daughters that none of their work's been published, but they have written beautiful poetry, written little cute short stories. You know, and they sketch, they do art. So creativity, it's unique, and this book does do that. It talks about the creativity of each one of these women.
Interesting. I really love hearing you talk about you love crafts. My mother made every dress, everything I ever wore, and I hated it. I tried them on 1,900 times, and she was a perfectionist, and I just hated and swore I would never sew. Well, because I don't sew, every one of my daughters does. But I think we've got to recognize that each one of us has a different skill. If I had to wake up in the morning and think, today I sew, I'd be burying myself. But I think of the different skills that you see here. But I think the real thing is to recognize what your own thing is and go ahead and do it, not try to be, like you say, anybody else.
I don't know if you're going to have Q&A.
We're going to go Q&A. I'm just going to make one more comment, and then we'll turn it over to question and answers. one of the things that I think is, for me, that was important about the book is how the interviews took place. Basically, you know, Jim and I would conduct the interviews together. One or two that Jim did by himself, one or two that I did by myself. But the most important part of it is that we actually paid attention to what the women were saying. It really was a conversation in that respect. I think, you know, if I were to ask you, did you feel like we were dominating the conversation or that we were listening? I think that's one of the things that lies at the heart of the success of this book, is that it's possible for men to listen to women. Many of you have that experience frequently. Ah, isn't that interesting? So, you know, even though it's not talked about in the book, it's one of the things that comes out in it. The ability to listen and to pay attention and to follow a story. And because of that, what's contained in here are very candid, revealing life experiences. And as the result, I am richer for it. Okay? Jim was richer for it. We felt this was important to share. But anyway, we'll go on. Let's go ahead and ask some questions. Go ahead and ask what you'd like. If you can't hear it, I'll repeat what the questions are.
Since this is a Set in Stone symposium, I'd like your points of view as the state of womanhood in the church and the nation and the world today.
Okay. And actually, that's good, because one of the questions we posed, or one of the things that we said as we questioned, was the biggest demographic in the church is single adult women. What would you have to say to them? You know, what would you want to talk to them about in the book? And so that's an appropriate question, because that's something that we did talk about. Would anyone like to respond?
Can't hear that.
Being a recent transplant to Salt Lake City, I have noticed my friends from out in the mission field and in Salt Lake, who've known me over the years, all want to know, are you okay? And I keep waiting for what is it they expect these people are going to do to me. But there's, now, if y'all go out and tell I said this, I'll probably lose my temper recommend, but I'm going to say it anyway. There's the church here in Salt Lake, and then there's the true church out in the mission field. When I go back to my ward in Chicago, my bishop says, well, welcome back to the true church. Let me hasten to add, there are in this valley some of the most kind, generous, righteous, good people who will help you with any worthy project willingly, gleefully. Folk don't have enough to do in Salt Lake. But there is also among women, I don't know what y'all do in the priesthood meeting, there's this tendency to want to shove everybody into a one-size-fits-all box. And most often, I guess, women allow themselves to be shoved into that box. Well, honey, I got too much to shove anywhere. It just won't do. And so, you know, the thing is, if folks were mean to you, it would be a simple thing to deal with. But they're not. People are very kind. And so it's a question of sharing perspective. If I say to young women, if you think that somebody's on your back, you got to stand up if you want somebody off your back. If, in fact, you have an opinion and you want to be heard, you have to be willing to speak that opinion after weighing all the possible ramifications of what it is you are going to say, and be willing to walk the walk as a result. Now, I'll tell you a funny story. In my ward, my last bishop, and this in Salt Lake, called all the older single women together. And I went because I just wanted, I was curious, what is he going to say? Because after 30 and you're single, bishops don't know what to do with you. So I go to this meeting and I listen to the women going around, and he wants to know what's working for them and what's not working for them. And there were some very poignant, tender moments in that session. So I didn't say anything. So then he said, all right, Stokes, what do you have to say? I said, I got nothing to say, Bishop. No, you have something to say. I said, okay, I told you. I said, you don't want to hear this. I said, I am so sick and tired of the foreplay and sacrament meeting, I could throw up. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, you're sitting up there on the stand, you're seeing it. They're up each other's back and round the neck and down the leg. And sometimes you think, now, how far is she going to go? Tell her to go home and bless the sacrament, you know? And he put his head down. I said, I told you I didn't want to say anything. But in fact, he met with the elders for him and talked to him about it. And for a while, it ebbed a little bit. But all of the women, particularly the older women in the room, said to me afterwards, I am so glad you said that. I said, well, why didn't you say something? But, nobody ever does. I only go to Relief Society periodically because I don't want to be the one raising my hand every Sunday and say, hey, wait a minute. That's not reality. If you are confronted with reality, with something that goes against reality, and you are silent, you lend consent. Dodd Hammarskjöld, who was, I think, the first Secretary General of the United Nations, said, never for the sake of peace or quiet deny your experience or your conviction. And I find this move to conform that women allow in the church. And I'm not saying be mean or whatever, but if you stay silent, it lends consent. I think the women in the church, when they have a project to do, they do it, and they do it with grace. Like the bishops say, well, if you want something done, give it to the Relief Society. And that's the truth, and we all know it, and it's wonderful. I wouldn't want to be anything other than a woman in this church or any other, because I believe women are indeed, to use that Mormon word, special. But it comes from God, and it comes from trying to either broaden a perspective or share an idea without alienating, and that is what it basically comes down to. And it's hard work. It's hard work. But when anybody, this is a bishop of mine in Chicago, said one in a Mother's Day talk, whenever there is an accomplishment that someone makes, there is a woman somewhere who has supported and fostered and encouraged that. More often than not, it's somebody's mother or grandmother or wife, but there is a woman there someplace. I think we've come to the point that we don't know who we are, and we have to rediscover that.
I just want to put in that there's also a man behind a woman. I can't tell you how much my husband's done to free me up to do the things I really love to do. He's been terrifically supportive. I've always felt so lucky that I haven't had to earn a living. Everything I've earned has been because I wanted to do something that I'm doing, and it was just a little serendipity to get a little pay for it. But he's always been there to help me in this way. And And he wasn't there a lot when the children were growing up. He's a real estate man, and he was gone. He said it had all the disadvantages of being a doctor and none of the advantages, because he was gone days, nights, all those things. But at the same time, he was always there when I needed him, or when the girls needed him. And I think it's very difficult, Kathy, for a man to be part of a strong woman in a combination. It's kind of hard, and I appreciate that.
But see, this is the thing.
I get your point.
That is a wonderful, all that many women could have.
Right.
Like, you know, if you could just put him in the Xerox machine and he passes out a copy. But look at the numbers. There aren't enough of them to go around. And I hope at some point people in the church teach their daughters, God still loves you if you're single. I have spoken to the young kids, you know, they always want me to come give my sex talk. Oh, I'm sorry, it's called the standard talk. Mormons are the only ones who believe it happens in the next life, but they won't say it in this one. But in that, I will ask all the kids to close their eyes, particularly if it's a young woman. I say, now, I want you to put your arm in the center where your person sitting next to you won't know what you do. And I want you to raise your hand if you feel you will have failed if you're not married. And let me tell you, it is astonishing that the overwhelming majority, like 90% of them, will think they have failed if they don't get married. There aren't enough to go around. Run the numbers. It's okay to be single. God loves you. But we're not doing that with our girls, as far as I can tell. Or you do it as either you have to be a doting wife or whatever kind of wife, or you have to be a strong single woman. And it's not an either or. You can do both. And the fact that you were blessed to not to have to earn a living is wonderful. And I long for today. Y'all can put the word out. I'm ready to not earn a living or to not take care of myself. No. But anyhow, there's a question back there.
Yeah.
I just have a question.
Come on up here. Yeah. That's okay.
I won't let you see who it is. I know I'm aloof from years past, off and on, but I just have a question. Do you ever feel like, because of who you are, you're kind of held up? You have a high. I'm thinking of you two specifically. With Catherine being African American, and I've read your story, and it's such a beautiful story. Do you ever feel like sometimes people single you out because you represent something that's kind of different, and there aren't as many of you, you know? And then Emma Lou, because you're from an old family and you're personal friends with all the in crowd of Salt Lake and all the general authorities, I feel like
actually they're friends with her.
Well, I know, but I feel like you can say
okay,
things.
Just, you
let,
know,
me just let me
go
just
ahead.
Raise my question. I feel like you can say get away with saying things that us little guys can't sometimes, and same with Emma Lou, that you, because you have a credibility, you can say things. And boy, if I said something like that, which I have a number of times, I don't have your high profile, and I don't have yours, so it's harder for some of us to find our voices. And I'm just wondering, I don't know what my question is, I guess.
Then you just quote them.
Well, I don't want to quote somebody else.
No.
Yeah. Well,
Angela's got the microphone. Well, that'll her start.
Well, I don't know what to say. I've only lived in Salt Lake for 6 years. I'm not in the in crowd, and I don't know very many general authorities. I know a few in my ward. That's all. But I've never had a problem. I have no credibility as far as my family's, you know, go back and or anything. I've never had a problem saying what I think. I think you have a perfect right, and it has a lot to do with how you say it. You know, my father was a diplomat, and I learned a lot about that. You can say a lot of things if you say it nicely.
If you're saying, do people ask me stuff and so forth because I'm black lady? Well, I'm going to tell you something. Particularly when I go to the temple, folks ask me if I'm Fijian, Tongan, Samoan, and so I wore my dress I had made in Fiji today just to confuse everybody. But there is Laurie Stromberg's husband said to me after I moved here, and I started talking about some of the encounters I have with people, he says, you have to realize that you are an oddity in this community. Since that time, I've always been odd, whether in a white community or a black community. I don't think I have access anywhere because I am black. I think I have access because I have paid my dues. And because I am committed to speak the truth. I have spoken many times on behalf of the church. I have traveled across the continents for the church. Nobody has ever told me what to say. Nobody. Even when I would have welcomed a little help. But the thing is, there is the expectation that we must be told everything. And I want you to try to separate out whether old women have more freedom than young women. That's a factor. I cannot separate out from that the fact that I am black. Don't want to. There is a missionary couple in my ward in Chicago who told a older black woman that, oh, don't worry, Mary, call her Mary. When you get to the celestial kingdom, you'll be as white as I am. So this lady, don't jump to judgment. This lady had been sick. This missionary couple had cleaned her house, had gotten her groceries, had taken her to the doctor. And, you know, when she called me with this, she said, why would they say something like that? I said, because they're ignorant. Get over it. Get over it. I said, do you think these people love you? As, you know, we think back through what all these things they have done and done lovingly. Well, yeah. Forgive them and move on. I said, you know, you got to have a sense of humor with these folks. I would have called the people back and said, you know, I called Salt Lake and they said not to worry about it because when we all get to the celestial kingdom, God is black and female. She couldn't pull that off. But I would have done that. That would have kept them on their knees for years. You know. But one thing that is, and I want to point out, in the Salt Lake Tribune last week, there was an article by Leonard Pitts talking about the dynamite in the warehouse. And he talked about the fact that race relations have become incoherent in America, where somebody like Mr. Beck says that Barack Obama hates white folks or hates the white culture. Then he goes on to say, well, he doesn't mean that he doesn't like them. Well, that's doublespeak. But nobody corrects them. The voice of white America, Rush Limbaugh and Mr. Beck, And where are the voices of reason? And what this reporter compares what they're doing to is walking through a warehouse full of dynamite with a torch. Because he says there is nothing in the American experience that is more, he didn't say tender, but I can't remember his word, on the American psyche, like race. But nobody will talk about it. Nobody will venture out to want to do that. And that is something that needs to take place. And I always bring to members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that if indeed this is the Lord's church, if we don't do that, tell me who will. The fact that I'm black, you know, I don't never worry about meeting folks someplace because they can always find me. And that's fine. There have been times when there was a need for somebody black to go to something because the folks wouldn't listen to the white folks. There have been times when I have told folks, no, I can't do that for you, staff, for the white folks to belly up. I can't do that one. But there has to be, at some point, a commitment to have that conversation, that dialogue that moves us toward one church. And please don't tell me about the Africans, because they are not in the same situation. See, there is no appreciation of black American culture. And I think that is because we don't have any land. There's appreciation and respect for the African culture. They got Africa. Land associated with a people sort of equals traditions and heritage. We have it too. We just don't have any land. And in that way, we are in fact unique. I long for the day that we move forward, all God's children, since we are, in fact, all are alike unto him, that we act out that creed and we stand as voices of reason in the community. That's not what you wanted, but that was the commercial.
I'm going to ask Victoria to respond to something, because in the book, one of the things that we talked about was your experience growing up in between Provo and Beaver, Utah, as about the only Asian person in the community. Could you talk about that a little bit? What your experience as, you know, in terms of race within our communities, how you saw it and experienced it in growing up?
And I've been thinking about this as Mary was talking.
Kathy, excuse me.
There's a lot of folks calling me Mary. I don't matter.
Like I said, I don't remember.
Be sure to pass the food.
I have a fantastic Relief Society secretary, and she.
Her name was Mary?
I don't know. Her name was Melissa, actually. But she helped me with the names because I'd say, who's that? Anyway, aside of the fact that I have to tell a little story first. It was a few years ago, and a friend was asking me about interracial marriage. And I sat there a few seconds, and I said, what do you mean? I says, my husband and I are interracial. And it just took her aback. Oh! And so I think it becomes, at least with, you know, as I've had my friends, that they just saw me for who I was, not for what I, you know, look like. And for me, because I was raised with Caucasian parents and Caucasian brothers and sisters, I feel as Caucasian as anybody until I look in the mirror. I love my husband for the fact that he always says, be proud of your heritage. I have just recently, well, it's been 20 and 25 years that I have actually been able to talk and visit with my natural family. On my father's side was first generation. I never saw my father alive when he passed away. We went down to the to his funeral, and they all spoke Chinese. I do not speak a lick of Chinese. And as I, you know, my husband was bishop and things, and people would call, they'd say, you know, talk to me like, you know, if you pick up the phone and talk to me, you wouldn't know I was Chinese, would you, until you saw me. And I had one friend say, I was totally amazed when you opened the door and you weren't white. So, you know, I've had those different things as I've been an adult. You know, it was more prominent for me when I was in southern Utah. I went to kindergarten through first grade or through second grade down in southern Utah, and there didn't seem to be a problem. I think it was after I moved back. I went to third, fourth, and fifth grade in Provo. And then things started to be a little different. And I did know I was different as far as how I looked. Like I said, and then going back to southern Utah, then there was a class, we having geography or something, and they started talking about the different colors of people. There was blacks, there was Indians, they had brown skin, and then there was Chinese, and they had yellow skin. And so for a long time I was teased with that particular, you know, it's called yellow. And that really, it made me uncomfortable. And I didn't, back then you didn't have, I didn't have the fortitude to go and say, you know, you just didn't go home and say, I'm being teased, you know, you just didn't do that. And so I just dealt with it. I just, you know, I tried to do the best I could with what was going on. I do have to say, and I tell the story in my book, or in my story, that it was my husband that stopped all that. He just got back from Vietnam, and there was a young man that went to his ward and knew my husband, and knew that he just got back from Vietnam, and I don't know what made him say what he did, but he said, she goes with Stephen Kessler, you better leave her alone. There was never any more derogatory words or anything said to me anymore after that. But I guess what I'm trying to point out is the racist back, you know, the different cultures was not as acceptable back in the 60s and 70s. It has gotten more so, I believe. I'm the only Oriental in my state, in Colorado. And I feel that I'm just as much a part of the sisterhood and whatever. And I feel like, you know, one thing I have to say is when somebody, you know, says, hey, you know, I'd like to meet you or whatever, and I'll say, well, I'm the only Oriental, you'll not have a hard time finding me. When I was Relief Society president and I would, you know, a new sister would move in, I'd say, well, you won't have a hard time. Well, you know, how will I know who you are? No problem. So, as I've grown up, and I'm still growing up, as I've dealt with this, I've come to realize I am who I am. I'm proud of who I am. And getting to know my family and my natural family and the culture, like I said, when, I'm kind of doubling back, but when I went to my father's funeral, they all spoke Chinese. I never felt so out of place in all my life. I looked like him. I looked just like my father. I looked just like him, but I sure felt out of my element. So, you know, the culture you grow up in, the environment you grow up in is kind of what you take in. But I've learned to like who I am. And I believe women in the church, the sky is the limit. And I have to say that because it doesn't matter what race you are or who you are, we are all daughters of God, and He loves each and every one of us. And no matter what our standing is or whatever, we are still daughters of God.
Yep.
Can I just add one thing? I come off, it sounds like as though I'm some privileged person who has all of these advantages, and I do. But I think one of the obligations of somebody who has this kind of advantage in some ways is to speak up and say, now, wait a minute. In Relief Society and anywhere, yesterday I was talking to a young woman who's my friend who's from Brazil. And she's being not very much accepted in her ward. It just bothers me to death. But I think it's my obligation to not only to support her and say, you're absolutely wonderful, but to say, I am going to do something about this. I mean, wherever we are, it's our obligation to do something, which I think everybody here does. And so I've been associating with people who are somewhere big in the church or something. All the more reason that I get to talk to one of those and say, you know what's happening? This is not right. This is not fair. And my whole life, I think because I did learn to boy talk, I could say this. And I feel I need to say this. And I want to say just a minute on a lot of things. So I think that's our major obligation.
Okay. Any questions? We've got about 5 or 6 minutes. Here. Come up to the microphone. Thanks.
Like to say that I heard Sister Stokes speak 15 years or so ago when I was a newly returned missionary, and it was very inspiring. And I have remembered many of those things that she said, and it has been they've been governing principles in my life ever since. So I just want to say those were fantastic experiences. 2 times that I heard you speak in Michigan. And 1 in Ann Arbor, and 1 maybe in Detroit, I can't remember. Anyway, but my question is, and in some ways some of you have already answered it, but I'll just throw it out there if there's something you want to add or tweak or whatever. I'm wondering if you had the chance to change one thing about Relief Society, what would it be? Or if you would prefer a different question, if you had the ear of general authorities again or ever, What would you advise them to really keep in mind when they're thinking about the women of the church?
I don't know.
Well, I'll start simple. We have 1 manual that Relief Society and priesthood would use, and we would include women in the manual. For example, I met one of Bell Spofford's grandsons riding to Preston, Idaho. I was so excited I almost jumped out the car. I said, that's really your grandmother? And then he went on to tell me stories about his grandmother. And she was some woman, let me tell you, she was. So in Relief Society, they asked that there was some reference to if you asked for the 10 most powerful women or the 100 most powerful women in the world, they would be movie stars. It wouldn't be women of the church. And I said it would in Bell Spofford's time. And you know what the women said? Who is Bell Spofford? That is a disgrace. She served under 5 presidents and probably was a thorn in the side of every one of them. Praise the Lord. But we need to put women back in the picture and teach out of the same manual. That would go a long way. We need to share with men all the good things that, and there are good things that are presented in the Relief Society manuals, but we aren't the only ones who need to know. And that's the one, now that's doable. Now get it done.
One thing about that I've found, you know, as I've been peddling the book to friends and others that have bought it, some men that would buy it for their wives, but they maybe peeked in it before they gave it to them, and then they wouldn't put it down. Because the nature of the conversation, I mean, it is possible to have an interesting conversation. It's possible for men to pay attention and listen to what women say. There are times when women have things worth listening to, right?
I could add something to that. I think there are also times that men have something interesting to say.
Men may have occasionally too. We both do.
Yeah.
But there was also a question raised while doing this book or coming out with it. Why is it that a couple of Mormon men felt like they could do this book? Fair question. No Mormon women did it. It's not like, you know, we were in a race.
And you
nobody
see how
else
hard it
did
was
it.
For them to do it.
This book. No Mormon women did this book. Okay? No Mormon women have gone out and done this. And if they had, it would have been different. Because the nature of the conversation between women and women is different than a conversation from women to men. A different response. Not better, just different. And I think what you say about having women addressed more in the manuals, I think that's an entirely appropriate and doable thing to do. Any other responses? We've got about 2 minutes, I think, or is our time up?
Yes.
Got to wrap it up? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sure.